Hi everyone, this is Bruce Herzog. My very special guest today is writer, producer, actor, and director Tom Jolliffe from the Big O UK. Tom, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me. Looking forward to it.
You're quite welcome. I got familiar with your movies that you've written scripts for. I've seen plenty of them. I have a lot more to go because Scott Jeffrey has a lot of movies that included you, and he seems to be a movie monster. I mean, making movies left and right. And I heard a background story about COVID and how crazy it was everywhere in the world, you know, knocking stuff out because it's so boring, nothing to do. Movie I want to start with first, I have not seen it, but I have it, and it's called Scarecrow's Revenge in 2019. Where did this idea come from and how did it go?
Yeah, so this was my first feature. Occasionally Scott and another producer he works with occasionally is Louisa Warren. So yeah, they every now and again they'll put sort of posts up looking for scripts and things like that. So I kind of responded to an advert and I sent them like a sample script, which they quite liked. We started discussing another film entirely. And then that kind of got delayed and pushed back. And then they just sort of said to me, well, would you like to write a Scarecrows versus Vikings film? And what I quite like these sort of movies anyway. So the more ridiculous a pitch I get, I sort of think, oh, well, I'd like to do that. So that's kind of where it started that, yeah, they pitched me the idea of, would you like to write Scarecrows versus Vikings? And yeah, I said, yeah. So that was kind of it. And then very, very quick turnaround. So I had to write this in like 3 or 4 weeks, I think it was.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And that kind of threw me into their kind of pace of doing things. Yeah. And since then, I mean, I've ended up writing things even quicker since then, but yeah. So I wrote it, I kind of got used to the way they worked. And this is basically they're working vicariously through a distributor, which I think was ITN, who they've worked with a few times.
Yeah.
So you kind of, yeah, you know, my preference for writing that one would have been maybe to have a little bit more comedy in it, or, you know, to kind of roll with how ridiculous the concept was. But a lot of the distributors don't like comedy, so we had to kind of keep it deadly serious. I was kind of limited because, obviously, in terms of budget, this was really low budget. So I was told that I could have either a Viking village or a castle. So I chose the Viking village to use. Then a little bit later on, I was told, actually, you might be able to use the castle for like one day. But unfortunately, not that I want to spoil it for you or anything, but the castle was kind of taken off last minute. So yeah, it was an interesting one. And it was one of these where I kind of got used to how things would turn out compared to what my expectation was. I think that kind of pulled my expectations back at what can be achieved at this budget level. So it was, yeah, it was an interesting learning curve. Lots of fun to write, but I think we were probably reaching beyond our means a little bit on that one.
Right. Now, it's like a double-edged sword, you know.
Yeah.
Being in the business myself, if we would try to make a film fully serious, you need a massive budget. All right. So what comes with low-budget films with a serious story, you almost have to throw in comedy, because if you don't, it's going to look really weird.
Yeah. And then the only thing you can sort of hope for then is if it's unintentionally funny. which I've heard from some people watching that there are moments in Scarecrow's Revenge which they find entertaining.
Well, I'm gonna watch it today though. It just, I love films like these. When I started 13 years ago as Gruesome Herzog, and I started on no budget, super low budget films, and you learn a lot. A lot of reviewers in the past 13 years ago would stand there and say, look, the movie's all right, but you know, there's a dark corner in this movie where the lighting wasn't right. Personally, I don't give a shit about lighting, okay? I understand that for a filmmaker to make a film, they have to make it to what they have to use to make it. Even to complete one is accomplishment itself. I look at storyline, you know, the writing, you know, the characters in the film. You know, I don't give a crap if the volume had to turn up your computer a little bit louder so you can hear it. There are a few of them, but that doesn't bother me. What I like is the creativity of how they use it and what they have to use. It doesn't have to be a grade A high budget film for me to enjoy it. I enjoy films for what they are.
Yeah. Makes sense? That makes sense. Yeah. I'm the same. I like to be surprised. So if the biggest mainstream stuff or maybe Disney stuff is all kind of becoming this big cycle where it repeats itself nonstop. Yes. You know, I kind of end up looking to the sort of indie stuff. And you know, I like to get taken by surprise. So if you're kind of skimming through Tubi or something, you might find something.
Oh, there's some good stuff by accident.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sadly for me in the UK, I don't have Tubi yet, but we have kind of similar things. It's not really, the whole kind of AVOD thing hasn't really caught on in the UK yet.
They will.
But we've got Freevee, which I believe they've got in the States.
Yes, we have that too. Yeah.
So, you know, I can do similar there where you just sort of pick something that either sounds ridiculous or sounds like it might be surprisingly good.
That's what I do all the time. The more strange it looks, the more I want to watch it. So I will definitely check out Scarecrow's Revenge. What movie were you working on? You said that you switched to Scarecrow Revenge. What was that one?
That was Cyber Bride.
Talk to me about it.
Yeah, that would have been my first one. So this was like, we were kind of inspired by Black Mirror.
Yeah,
it was an interesting one because, again, we were a little bit hamstrung by the budget. It's this film where it's probably the one that I'm kind of least satisfied with from my own personal point of view. We kind of rewrote and it became a little bit frustrating because we're trying to work within the means of the budget. So I would write the script and then we would have to take things out. So we would have to trim characters back, which means this is effectively trimming back kills. So the money shots and where all the action is. So I had to sort of trim those back. We couldn't quite work out an ending because, you know, when you're doing like a sci-fi film, you're having to sort of build up to a finale basically. And if you've got no money, you can't particularly have a big finale of any kind. And they're shooting these things on like 5 to 7 days as well. So, you know, very tight turnarounds. But for that one in particular, there's like a middle section of the film where I thought, you know, the cast did really well. And we kind of delved into some, I guess, like philosophical notions about existence and, you know, humanity. So there's some interesting things in the kind of middle section of the film. But in terms of the spectacle, we couldn't really get enough of what we would need for that kind of film, really. So, yeah. And from my point of view as a writer, it got to a point where I kind of handed the script over and I sort of done the best I could. And we still didn't particularly have an ending. And then, yeah, so by the time it got shot, they'd kind of added things back in. So things that I'd taken out, like characters that get killed off and, you know, have a place in the story, they kind of put things back in because the distributor sort of turned around and said, well, actually, there's not quite enough action in this. So they go and put things back in, but they're not tied to the story. So whereas before I'd put something in with a character tied to the story, you know, they're now cramming stuff back in because it's last minute. So it's like, well, we've just got to have a random scene that's not particularly connected to the main story. So, yeah, it's just, you know, awkwardly kind of crammed back in. So that was one probably my most disappointing, although there are, yeah, like I say, from the two main leads are really good in it. And there's some aspects in the middle of the film which are a little bit more kind of, I guess, in the vein of Black Mirror, which I quite liked.
Yeah. Now, you being a writer, of course, that is your baby. So when changes are made, I understand that, you know, it. Yeah, I get it. There's a franchise that I'm assuming that you did part two, that you didn't write the first one, The Tooth Fairy.
Yeah. So I wrote the second one and the third one.
Yeah. Okay. I started watching the first one and I went to work and I totally did not get a chance to finish it, but I will. Tooth Fairy, as you know, obviously it's a super low budget film and you really have to, again, we went back to my point again, you really have to desire films that are low budget, because if you can't grip it, you're not going to understand it or like it. That's a lot of reviewers in the past. They want to be Howard Sterns on their podcasts and trash films. Me, I'm complete opposite, because I love films that aren't perfect because they're still fun. They can still have a good story. Tooth Fairy to me was one of these franchises that I'm assuming after they did the first one, I'm assuming that it picked up enough to do a part two, am I correct?
Well, I'm not too sure how many they've got to this point. I think they've got up to number 5 or 6 now.
Yeah.
But someone else has obviously long since taken that over from me. But my one comes like 10 years after the first one. So there's a kid in the first one who is now the lead character in the second one.
Okay.
Yeah, so he's now an adult and he's kind of got PTSD from what happened in the first film. That one was quite interesting to me because, again, this is one of those things where, for me, I was quite happy with certain aspects of the dramatic side of it, whereas I think, obviously, because of budgetary problems and a few other problems, the kind of horror elements didn't quite work well as they could have. But I think there's aspects of, like, the psychological horror in it that I think worked quite well with the lead character in my one, Return of the Tooth Fairy. There was quite an interesting, quite a sort of funny story on set though. And it kind of sums up the luck that sometimes you have on these films where, you know, the morning of a shoot day, a makeup artist can't make it. And so they're kind of rushing around last minute. And then what was going to be 3 kind of elaborate death scenes in 3 different places, they had no real way around it. So basically what they had to do is keep these 3 characters all together in the same place. And they had to have this mythical kind of demonic tooth fairy somehow find a gun from somewhere and then just shoot them all in one go. so I've just bought the movie for you there, but
no. See, it's fun that when you say stuff like that, there, it's when that scene comes up when I watch it, I can relate. There you go. That's how I look at it.
Yeah. So you know, rather than these 3 elaborate gory deaths, there was just, you know, 3 people getting shot at the same time.
no, I do want to see.
They didn't even bother to put sort of muzzle flashes on the gun. You know, you can sort of barely tell that this tooth fairy is shooting a gun. Yeah, it was just a bit awkward, but it's just one of these things where you've got your budget in place. The distributors handed them over the cash to do it, and there's really no room for reshoots or, you know, anything like that, because if you end up missing any footage or having any problems, same as if you have any problems with sound in post, a lot of these films just get, sometimes they'll get permanently shelved, or they'll get shelved for, you know, 6 months, 12 months, and, you know, just waiting for someone to kind of finish it up.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, that film also had, this is one of my, one of the great paradoxes of independent filmmaking. You know, you'll get some distributors and they've got these deliverables you have to give with, you know, with your film. So you've got to deliver with no kind of issues whatsoever, no sound issues, no picture issues, at least what that's what they say. And you're jumping through hoops to kind of make it. So you're submitting, then you might resubmit.
Right.
Each time you could be paying someone again and again to kind of fix things in your sound issues and things like that. So you've got that where you're trying to really kind of jump through hoops to deliver, to pass quality control. And then in the end, you'll go and watch a film, or you'll watch a film from the same distributor, and there's, you know, there's masses of sound issues, there's picture issues. So, for the Tooth Fairy 2, for example, there are a lot of sound issues on that. So, you know, it just baffles me that sometimes, you know, you'll get distributors that really want you to jump through hoops and have deliver something perfect with no issues, and then you see what's delivered and there's sound issues. I mean, this could come from maybe, you know, one distributor gives it to another distributor in a territory. So for example, ITN sell a lot of films to High Flyers in the UK.
Right.
They do a lot of DVD releases. So the DVD I've got has a lot of kind of picture issues and sound issues. That could be from going from one distributor to another. So if the filmmaker has spent all this time trying to deliver and pass quality control, you know, it's now been handed off to someone else. And then maybe through the transfer or the upload, I'm not really too technical, but, you know,
yeah.
It's ended up in the shops with loads of sound issues, is, you know, basically my point. But yeah, it's just one of those things in indie filmmaking that, you know, you're asked to jump through all these hoops, and then you go and see the final thing, and then there's all these sound problems. So
ITN put out a lot of movies. So, I mean, a lot. I mean, I've seen some that have audio issues. I don't care. I mean, I know it matters to somebody, but
yeah,
if it's watchable, who gives a shit? So that's my theory. I mean, I'm a horror film nut, so I can watch almost anything. Well, to a point. There are some filmmakers in America that I cannot handle watching their movies because their actors aren't actors, and I can't deal with that. I mean, we all can try whatever, but when it gets, yeah. Anyways.
Yeah.
I talked to Nicola, as you know, and she mentioned this. I mentioned this movie with her, but you had one called Witches of Amityville Academy. She gave me her story on that. How was that for you as far as writing it? Did the movie come out the way you wanted it to, or is it another one that, you know, you're not quite happy with?
I was really happy with this. This is one of my favorites. I think it didn't really latch on with, I guess a lot of these indie films get kind of slated by people online, but I don't think it, horror is a bit funny because you've got fans and they're quite territorial with what kind of horror they like. So, you know, if you're trying to please one kind of section of fans, like the gore hounds, you won't please the ones that like a little bit more kind of psychological horror, and vice versa. So, you know, we were kind of going for something a little bit campy. And it's not like, you know, it probably could have done with a bit more gore and, you know, some, you know, better money shots in it, I guess. Because it comes across as like a few reviews said, it comes across as like sort of, I guess, Nickelodeon, like a Nickelodeon horror, which to me is not necessarily a bad thing.
No, it's not.
Yeah,
it's
so... Not. yeah, it was quite campy, quite fun. So the lead, the three leads were kind of producers on it, including Keira Reid-Lorsch. So she's like an Emmy winning producer and an Emmy nominated actress.
Nice.
Yeah, so it was a, I thought it was a really fun film. So I really enjoyed it. I enjoyed the chemistry of the cast in that one. But it's not like, you know, really violent or anything, or it's not a really dark, scary horror film. It's, yeah, like I say, a little bit campier. I think we kind of nailed that. But, you know, I think from maybe audiences were expecting something a lot darker and more gruesome, really.
Oh, well, it is what it is. I mean, I have to watch it yet. I'm going to, like I said, I have a lot of your films that you've written that I had to watch. Let's go into Tooth Fairy, the third one. How did that turn out for you compared to the second one, I should say?
Yeah, I think, again, that's another one that generally I don't particularly like doing sequels. So I don't mind taking on a sequel. So, you know, in the case of like the second one where I took on something that someone had already written, it's kind of like that. I don't like to repeat myself. So
I'd
kind of done that one. We had another time shift. So the lead character from the first film, second film and third film, it kind of jumps 10 years between each of the first three films. So in the second one, he's kind of like sort of 20-ish. The third one is another like 15 or so years later. So from that point of view, I found it quite interesting writing the character at two different ages. But I think, again, we had to sort of repeat a lot of what we did in terms of character development in the second one. So again, it's, you know, PTSD is like a main theme in it. Yeah, I think it was certainly in terms of a production, it was tidier and it was more, in terms of like the kills and things, it was had more impact. But I think I probably did prefer the second one.
Okay.
Because of what we covered in more of like the psychological horror aspect of it.
Right. There's a couple here I'm going to run off. I haven't seen, but I have them. Legend of Jack and Jill, A Ouija Host. These two, you want to talk about one each a little bit, because A Leprechaun's Curse, I have some information for that one.
Yeah. Okay. So, Jack and Jill, that was an interesting one. That was kind of one of the early ones that, Scott did, where he's doing kind of riffs on old fairy tales and things like that, and nursery rhymes.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of, that might have been one of the first, actually. So that kind of started the ball rolling, where they're doing everything like Three Blind Mice, which is coming out quite soon.
And obviously
Winnie the Pooh as well. Things like that. So yeah, Jack and Jill, that was quite a fun one to do. It's sort of the Hills Have Eyes kind of vibes. And yeah, I was quite pleased with how that one turned out. There was a few things that kind of got, again, it was a bit similar to Scarecrow's Revenge. So I had an idea for the opening and then we had to change it and I rewrote it. But then between the point of me handing the script over and then them shooting it, they've rewritten it slightly again, but gone back to kind of what I'd done in the first place. It's just one of these things where it happens quite often, but
yeah,
they kind of do a complete reverse. And there were a few kind of aspects to some of the characters that were kind of thrown in a little bit awkwardly. But other than that, I was quite pleased with how it turned out. It was really nicely shot as well by Jack Peter Mundy. So he's worked with Scott a few times and he's normally a really reliable kind of DP. So yeah, the film looks nice. I think there's some good kills in it. The two actors playing Jack and Jill did a really good job as well. So I think, yeah, it's a good slasher. And that one seemed to do really well. I think just combined through all the channels it's been on. It's been on a few of the YouTube horror channels, including everything else like Tubi and that. But it must be clocking up nearly, 10 million views, maybe more.
Wow. I'm definitely going to watch that one. I have that one too. And there's a bunch of movies in America about the Ouija board and all that there, but this was called a Ouija house.
Yeah.
Now, is that what I think it is? But is it like on a platform? Or is it, you know how they make movies that they're on Zoom and all that stuff? Is it something a little bit different?
It's a little bit different, really. It's more like a ghost investigation program. I don't know what, like paranormal investigators or something like that. It was a little bit interesting. I mean, originally it was called Ghost Host. So I think the Ouija side, it doesn't really make sense for what's in the film, because I don't know if they ever actually use a Ouija board in it. They've just used the Ouija title as clickbait, basically. So I think that's probably a distributor edition. Actually, just going back quickly to Amityville Witches, I mean, the Amityville thing was added in halfway through the writing process. So that again was an afterthought by the distributors to make it more appealing, I guess.
There's a lot of titles called Amityville. There's a lot of them now. Yes, there is.
Yeah, and it didn't necessarily feel, that might be partly why, some of the reviews might have picked up on that as well. But yeah, with the Ouija hosts thing, I kind of did it because it was scripting what's supposed to be kind of reality television, if you like. So, like a lot of these reality shows, they're partly scripted anyway. So I found it quite interesting to write in terms of scripting what's supposed to be like a reality show. I did watch it, but I'm not sure that there's much, if at all, that remains from my original script. Because a lot of it, they would have improvised as well. They actually did shoot it at a genuine kind of haunted location. And I know that the director, Stephen M. Smith, he does a lot of these things. So he does a lot of things, sort of films about hauntings. He's done a lot of kind of semi-reality films as well. And he's filmed at a lot of these genuine haunted locations as well. From what I gathered, Louisa and everyone else on the production of the film had a few interesting incidents, really, a few strange, unexplained sounds. I think what they did is they added a few kind of voiceovers in and a few awkward things. So there's a bit of an awkward mixture in that. So I'm not sure it quite came out, at least how I originally thought it would, anyway.
Yeah, I don't think Stephen M. Smith likes me too much. I don't know. I reviewed a movie of his, I guess when he first got started, and I was honest. I mean, I didn't bash it. I mean, I didn't give it I might give it a 5 or a 6, and I think he took it personal. Because ironically enough, he sent me a message, hey, I got a new film. And then when he realized who I was, he like disappeared. It's like, I didn't hear from him again. This is like last year or so. But it is what it is. I mean, I can't please everybody. I mean, I can't lie either. I mean, I can't say a movie's great when, because I'm very honest in my reviews, hey, I mean, I'm cool. I mean, maybe who knows? But the movie that Leprechaun movies, the originals, one from 93. And I watched the most recent one on that one. Oh, my God. For a high budget, I thought the character of the leprechaun was so annoying. His stupid laugh. It really brought me into a cool part about that new one was the guy from the original was in there and he got killed. That's how the leprechaun got born. But then I checked out The Leprechaun's Curse. Now, mind you, we're talking about complete different ends of budgets. So people don't get confused. All right. This is not no $10 million budget film. I did a review on Leprechaun's Curse. I don't know if you can check it out on my YouTube channel. It's there. You just got to search for it. I enjoyed this film. I really did. I thought it was clever. I thought it was different. He had a bunch of kids that took the gold, and the Leprechaun wants it back. And I mean, it's somewhat of a same similar idea with the original Leprechaun. But I really, really liked this film. I was really surprised by it. How was your feelings towards Leprechaun's Curse?
Yeah, I mean, this one I had a lot of fun writing. I think what was different than a lot of the things I've done is that we had a bit more license to kind of, you know, make a few jokes and have a bit of humor in it. So, you know, there was a little bit of an element of tongue in cheek to it, which I think helped. Because, you know, when you're filming that quickly and on such a low budget, you've got this kind of like the mask in it isn't particularly great. And you can sort of see the sort of flap of the mask just not connecting with the guy's neck. So I think, you know, if you're being humorous with it and not taking it too seriously, then it becomes a little bit more acceptable. You can kind of lean into it a bit more. But yeah, I know I had a lot of fun writing this one. We could crack a few jokes in it and just have fun with it. I think, you know, if you're making a film like that, you know, a Leprechaun film, you should sort of have a bit of fun with it, I think. It was another one that's a bit confusing, though, because my one was the second one. So Louise has done, I think, two or maybe three Leprechaun films. Mine was the second, and it's got a couple of different names depending on the territory, but it's also got the same name as the first film in one particular territory. So, yeah, so it's easy to get confused. So mine is called Leprechaun's Curse and Leprechaun's Rage, depending on where you view it. Yeah, it's just a bit confusing, really. Again, it's just, yeah.
Leprechaun's Game.
That might be one of the other names, yeah. So, because, you know, every now and again, I will buy my own films just so I've got them on a collection if they've been given a physical release. So, yeah, completely by accident, I almost bought the first one, which has nothing to do with me. But, yeah, I did look closer and managed to get my version. But, yeah, like I say, it was a lot of fun to write. And it's one, you know, I watched and had a lot of fun with.
Are you there?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, you mentioned about confusion. I seen Leprechaun's Game. I did a review on that one. The Curse I have to watch. So I apologize. It's funny you mentioned that. That's exactly what it got me. I did see the Game. So I do have the Curse. Okay.
I have no idea which is which. I think there's been Leprechaun's Curse, Leprechaun's Vengeance, Leprechaun's Rage, Leprechaun's Game. loads of different names and just two films. But yeah, the first and second one have had the same name in different territories, which got confusing even for me.
Yeah, well, I had this confusion with when we had an interview, and you noticed that I get confused with titles like Bad Nun this and Bad Nun that, but
yeah.
Jurassic Island I liked.
Yeah, I quite liked that one as well.
Talk to me about it.
Yeah, this was one that was, I was writing it. It was, again, it was one where we had to kind of take things out and then they got put back in. One of the things that did get put back in is that there's an opening with a big ship, which we didn't have available when I was first writing. So we were going to try and have to work around that by using VFX and then maybe mocking up an interior. In the end, right. I just had to rewrite a different way where to get to this mysterious island, they go through like a wormhole. But because they ended up having access to a ship, they rewrote it back to an original idea where they just go on a ship, roll up at this island. Then the whole middle section is kind of mine. And then there was an end section, which they probably rewrote again. But again, all they said to me was, I think Nicola said the same thing, actually, that she was offered it, and do you want to do a dinosaur movie? And she's like, yep, that was me as well. So do I want to do a dinosaur film? Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, I thought we had a little bit of fun with it. It's one of those where, again, reviewers always pick up on these things where, well, there's this whole subplot where there's these poisonous leeches that turn people into zombies. And it's like, well, why can't we have more dinosaurs? Well, dinosaurs cost money, unfortunately. So, you know, you have to kind of, you know, fill out the runtime and pad something out with like a subplot. So, you know, that was our subplot to kind of make up for those moments which didn't have dinosaurs.
Exactly.
But, I enjoyed that one though. And, you know, anytime I've got Nikki in a film, it's always good because you know that she's going to bring, you know, she's going to be really good. Sarah T. Cohen is always really reliable as well.
Yep. Now, it's like a broken record. We always go back to this. You know, I love the idea of having these leeches making tribute to zombies to dinosaur film because I understand it takes money for dinosaurs. So the best way to do that is to break it up and make something else with it. And I totally understand. A lot of people don't understand that. You know, they think because you make a movie, you're rich. No, that's not how it works.
Yeah, it can be difficult, really, because, you know, their point of comparison is always maybe what they're seeing on the big screen or seeing on Disney Plus, you know, and these things cost. I mean, even Disney now, they're making things for over $100 million and they look cheap because they're kind of they're spreading their CGI artists so thin and overworking them that everything ends up looking a bit cheap. And you know, if you say a film costs $250 million, maybe there's a big chunk of that is going in someone's pocket. But you know, if their films look cheap at that budget, you know, we've got no chance. I think, you know, they would complain even more if there was, you know, long stretches where nothing's happening. So, you know, like this one. And then obviously we'll probably talk about Varnado later, but there's, you know, that's the same. There's some question there.
So I'm going to pocket these two together. Reign of Chaos and Wrath of Van Helsing.
Yeah. Reign of Chaos was an interesting one because that was actually my second film in terms of what I wrote. And that came out very much like I'd written. It was kind of really, really low budget, even, you know, by comparison to some of the other ones. But from where Scott started to where he is now, there's been a gradual progression of, you know, how much money goes into some of these films. Mm-hmm. So this is very much on the early side of it where, you know, they've had to shoot it very quickly. It's supposed to be a sci-fi action film. There's meant to be lots of sort of martial art fights in it. Problem is that you then have this issue where they've not cast people who can fight and they've not got time to choreograph or train them up. So, you know, the fights didn't quite work in that. I do like the cast in it, though. I think they've got good chemistry in it. It's one that I think it probably looks better in script format than it's turned out just because of where they've had to cut so many corners. And it got stuck in post for maybe 2 years, I think, before it eventually got released. So they had all sorts of issues where, again, like I said earlier, that sometimes these films get left and sort of until someone gets a chance to kind of go back to it and chip away at maybe fixing visual effects or fixing sound. So eventually it did get released. Van Helsing was a bit more of a tight turnaround. That came a bit later, but that was, again, it didn't quite have enough time for what it required. But I think, you know, there's some good elements in there, like the lighting. And there are some good visual effects and makeup effects in that. But again, it's just you've got this, everything is set in this one location, which a lot of these films have to be, but, you know, you're filling out time, so there's a lot of there's a lot of parts where people are just sort of walking through these tunnels. They've probably even had to trim back from my script in moments as well. So it didn't quite turn out as it could have done, but I think there's a good interplay between Van Helsing in it and the guy that plays Igor. Although, weirdly, I think the two actors that they cast probably would have worked better flipping the roles, if you know what I mean. So, yeah, they've got, sometimes in these films you get a good cast, but maybe they're in the wrong role or they're miscast.
Yeah. Well, there's one that you posted the other day that it just got released, When Darkness Falls.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure you were proud of this one.
This is probably, you know, thus far, it's probably my favorite one. I was more kind of directly involved. I kind of sort of unofficially co-produced it, I guess, if you like. And I did some of the casting in it. And yeah, myself and Nathan, who is the producer, director, we go way back. So, you know, we've been friends over a decade. We have similar tastes in films, and it just got to the point where we'd been working on certain things we've wanted to do for quite a while, but we need sort of a bit more money to do it. So we just sort of thought, well, let's do an idea we can kind of do low budget, quite easy to do. We'll make the most of like the Scottish Highlands as a backdrop.
Oh, I love that.
And we really wanted to do kind of like a mystery thriller. It's difficult for me in terms of commissions. So I always get asked to do, it's pretty much all horror or action or sci-fi, because those are the things that sell. Distributors don't tend to go for things like, you know, like a mystery thriller, unless you've got maybe like one or two big names in it.
Right.
So yeah, we just thought, let's do shoot something really low budget, but, you know, try and make something as good as we can. Just an old school throwback. So, you know, one of those old sort of potboiler thrillers that, you know, there's twists and turns, you know, through start to finish. But we really wanted to do something kind of slow burning that builds up to a good finale, I think we did pull off. We got some good reviews for that. Probably, you know, in terms of what I've done so far, that was the one where I got most good reviews, I think.
Yeah. It has a 5 rating too. It's higher than, I mean, you can't really go by IMD ratings because anybody can put anything, but it's higher than most of the ones you had besides the next one, the Area 51 incident. What was that like?
Yep. Again, that was kind of pitched to me as we want to do something a little bit along the lines of Aliens, which I was, you know, game for. So, you know, this group of scientists, there's a big sort of alien invasion after they accidentally open up this time portal or wormhole or something or other. They kind of hunker down in this bunker, like an Area 51 that's in the UK. Again, some of these things are a little bit awkward in terms of casting or where you're not too sure where a film is set. So distributors often want American actors in the films, or they want people doing American accents so they can kind of relate to their main audience, because, you know, the main market is the US. It's always been the US for all my films. So we either set them in the US and try and work our way around that, or we set them in the UK and we try and fit in maybe one or two American characters. So, I mean, this one got a little bit sort of confused, I guess, on the geography of where it was. But, you know, that aside, I think it's really good. The effects are really good for the budget. This one had a little bit more spent on it than some of the others. So, you know, I've done films which range from budgets, you know, upwards of like 7,000 all the way up to sort of 4 or 5 million. This one is somewhere maybe $50,000-$60,000 in terms of a budget, which can be like double what some of the other similar ones would be. Something like Van Helsing probably cost a lot less, for example. So, yeah, I mean, the visual effects in this were really well done. There's a little bit of comedy in the film, and it, you know, there's moments of drama as well. So, you know, I do think it worked quite well compared to maybe some of the others that we've done, which are kind of sci-fi.
The director of this one was the one that was the director of Winnie the Pooh, Fries Frake Waterfield. Might get him on my show sometime in the future just to pick his brain about Winnie the Pooh. I would love that.
Yeah.
Because Area 51, you mentioned something about, and I did notice this, I watched a movie called Amityville Scarecrow that was done in England. And I was wondering, and I loved it, by the way. I'm going to watch part two as well. But I was wondering, I mean, are they trying to say that there's a town called Amityville in England? Are they trying to make it sound like it's in the United States? I could never, again, I don't give a shit about that at all. But I often wondered about that. Andrew Jones was a filmmaker in England. You remember him? He passed away.
I do, yeah.
God bless him. He's a great guy. And I watched, and he had films too that were like American tragedies in England. So it can be done anywhere. I mean, it doesn't, I don't really care, but I just was wondering, is there actually a town called Amityville in England?
Not as far as I'm aware. I think what it is sometimes is that, you know, at one, maybe early on in the process, we'll decide, look, this is going to be set in England. Then later on in the process, maybe very late on sometimes, distributors might say, well, can we set this in the US instead? But then, you know, they're not changing around the script. So some things get left in, some things do get changed. So you get confusing things like there's radio announcements which are talking about states, or or it might be that it's set in the US, but you've got a radio announcer talking about counties rather than states. It's just, you know, it's a continuity thing sometimes as much as anything else.
So what you're saying is you got a plane full of British people coming to America.
A bit awkward, I think. Sometimes
it's funny, though. I can't help it. It's funny. I don't care.
Yeah.
But it's funny.
And, you know, people will always, you know, pick up on things like, you know, Americans will never say that. But, you know, if I've written it as a British character and then they change it to American at the last minute, you know, no one's gone through this and gone line by line and changed the lexicon.
That's funny. You know. You're too much.
But, you know, the distributors have all the money, so you have to make them happy, don't they? Don't you? So,
you do. Well, you have two action disaster films.
Yeah.
Mega Lightning, I do want to watch. I love disaster films. I'm a weirdo. I mean, we all are. But how was Mega Lightning?
This was interesting, this kind of double bill. I think I did Firenado first. But yeah, I'm the same. I love these disaster movies, you know, asylum movies or sci-fi channel movies.
Oh, I love them. Kidding me, all those shark movies? Yeah. I don't care how stupid they are, they're good.
So yeah, they said, do you want to do a Mega Lightning film? I said, yep, absolutely. Firenado film, yep, definitely. It was quite interesting with these because, again, this is a good comparison point between Firenado, which is probably almost twice the budget, and you can kind of tell because the visual effects are better. You know, the photography.
Even the trailer. Even the trailer.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's still the budget level where you're going to have issues to deal with, and you're going to have to ration out the Firenado itself. But I think, so I don't know if you know this, but Mega Lightning was featured on Red Letter Media. If you know Red Letter Media.
Oh, yeah.
I love watching Red Letter Media anyway, so that was a kind of point of pride for me, even though they tore the film apart. The one thing they didn't sort of rag on, though, was the script, so I should probably take that as a victory. I think that was a lot of fun to write. There were a few changes in the final script. I think they kind of had this, they made the villain a lot more theatrical and kind of like he was out of something, like some Shakespeare play or something, which actually I think this probably helps the film a bit more, because it's got a certain comedy value. It's one of those, it's maybe not necessarily intentional, but it's quite a funny film to watch. But in terms of Fionado, we could approach that one with a little bit of tongue in cheek. I mean, there's a line in there where someone says, "Oh, we need to engage the hyperdrive," and they, you know, put a booster on their car. So, you know, part of the inspiration on that one, for example, was Back to the Future. So you got the kind of Doc Brown character in it, played by Toby Wynn Davis. And then Nicola's in that one as well. And again, it's almost like the, in terms of like the Scott kind of pool of talent, it's like the best of the best in that film.
Right. Nicola was in Fionado. I can hear her in the trailer.
Yeah. And again, you know, she's really good. So she, you know, she always brings something good to the table.
Yeah, I really enjoy watching her perform because she really gets into it. I think she's a phenomenal actress. A lot of the actresses that's in Scott Jeffries films or Scott Summers, a.k.a., that a lot of them do a great job. I've seen a lot of the same actresses in the movies, but you know, I know that when I see them in these movies, I know the acting's going to be up to par. So.
Yeah, same. So, I mean, you know, I do have my favorites. Where I think, I know it's in good hands.
So now we have one that I'm going to watch. I'm not sure if there's two of them, but War of the Worlds, The Attack.
Yeah.
Is that the only one?
That is the only one, yeah.
Okay, talk to me.
I mean, there's been about 500 different War of the Worlds films, but it's the only one of mine.
Of course.
Yeah, that was an interesting one. I mean, that probably came maybe my second or third film, but obviously because they spent a lot of time sorting out the visual effects in post-production, so it took about 2 or 3 years until it got released. That was a really fun one to do. I think initially I went on board to just do a bit of script editing on it and sort of sort out some dialogue, but I stayed on it a bit longer and then became a co-writer and added more scenes to it. It's one of those, the director Jay Syed has come from a visual effects background. So he's done quite a few big films working as a VFX artist. So he kind of can oversee the visual effects in this. It's almost like you're getting a higher standard, but you're not paying as much because he's getting people in, you know, on favors or mates rates, or he's doing a lot of it himself. So obviously this takes a long period of time, but it's a really kind of fun adventure film. And also it's not sort of gruesome or anything like that. It's quite I guess it's more of a family film. And so it was nice from my point of view, being able to watch this one with my daughter, probably the first, right. The first one of my films that I could actually kind of like introduce her to. So it was nice sitting down as a family and watching that one. Yeah, it was just one of those where we had fun with it. We wanted to have like a good close-knit group of the lead actors, and they have good chemistry in it. And there's a bit of, you know, banter between them. I think it's a fun version. I think it's quite true to the original story, although it's obviously set in modern times. They do feature a lot of the locations from the original story as well. It's one of those where it's also probably got similar problems to every version that stays faithful to H.G. Wells. It's that, you know, in the book, it kind of like just ends abruptly. So, you know, you stay true. So it kind of, it's a bit similar really. So,
right.
Yeah, we could have taken a bit more creative license maybe, but then you know, people would complain, oh, it's not like the book.
Yeah, yeah. I do. That's on my watch list. Now, we talked the other day, and I'm Sky Monster. It seems to be like something that looks very, very different as far as filming wise.
Yeah, this was an interesting one because they came to me one day and said, oh, we've got access to like a plane set in a week's time. Can you write something? So they said, well, what we're thinking of is like a monster film. So like a big monster in the sky or something. So we came up with the idea of like a sky kraken. And then I wrote it kind of double quick time. I'm quite interested to see that one, see how it turns out really, because again, that was really fun to write. It was nice to have that kind of, that quick time scale and pressure. And again, we could have a little bit of fun with it as well. So we weren't overly serious. We know it's kind of like a silly monster movie, a B movie. And we could have a few fun moments in the film. I'm really looking forward to seeing how that one turns out. Should be quite interesting, that one.
Cool. There's one that it's done or they're still making it. Cinderella's Revenge looked very, very interesting.
Yeah, this was really interesting. I mean, so Winnie the Pooh, Blood and Honey, I was actually offered that one originally. But I kind of had all these things stacking up at the same time, so I had to turn it down. Whether or not I regret that, I don't know. I haven't decided yet. it wouldn't have made me rich. I don't think so. So, and again, because it's ended up in the hands of kind of like mainstream critics, if you like, because it kind of like, it's almost by accident that it ended up being, a big theatrical release and ended up getting reviews in things like The Guardian in the UK, critics like Mark Kermode as well. So it's being reviewed alongside sort of theatrical films, but really initially the goal was probably, well, we want something that's going to do really well on AVOD and do well enough that we're going to get a couple of sequels out of it. Obviously it went viral, went unexpectedly big, but yeah. That was a big surprise. But I turned it down because basically I was offered a chance to work with Mark Lester, obviously director of Commando, Firestarter, Class of 1984. Yeah. And I'm, you know, a massive fan. So like Commando, I must watch twice a year at least. It's just one of the easiest things you can switch on and watch. I had a good chance to work with him. Along with another studio in America. And then it was Rebecca Matthews who was kind of overseeing the UK production. So it was an interesting film in terms of you got three companies kind of working together, which can make it a bit awkward with notes and things like that in terms of things. Because everyone has their different ideas and there's like, you know, there's three people from one company, there's like seven or eight from another. Everyone's got their differing ideas. Every now and again, someone will throw in an idea that doesn't make any sense. But you kind of have to consider it because they've got the money. Right. No, but I think in the end, it's in terms of the script anyway, it came out very well. And I knew kind of from the outset that they were looking to get someone in like quite a big name for the fairy godmother in the film.
Asha Henstridge.
Yeah, so I was very pleased with that as a massive fan of hers in the mid-90s. Probably watching Species more times than I should have done. so that was just amazing experience. And then I've done a couple more with Mark since then that haven't quite made it to IMDb yet, but they'll be coming in due course.
All right. Well, you have your own baby that you're working on. And I've seen the concept trailer, The Baby in the Basket.
Yeah. How's so that? This is very much a passion project. Again, this is with Nathan Shepka, who directed When Darkness Falls. We're constantly kind of coming up with ideas and making plans to do films. Because again, you know, we want to make the same kind of films. We want to make we want to make them as good as we possibly can as well. Even, you know, when you're fighting against budgetary restraints. I kind of wanted to make a conscious decision at the beginning of the year or kind of late last year to kind of slow down on the commissions I was doing. It didn't always work because I've done quite a few since then. You know, someone will come up to me, do you want to do this? And I'll say, okay. So I've tried to slow down a bit to kind of concentrate more on the things that I guess that I want to do a bit more rather than someone comes to me and says, do you want to do, you know, a Fionado film? This one, again, we were really inspired by old school horror films. So we were kind of inspired by stuff like, you know, films from the 40s right up to the 70s. Things like The Omen and Rosemary's Baby, Black Narcissus, they were kind of big inspirations to us. And we wanted to do something quite dark and gothic. And again, make use of kind of Scottish locations. So Nathan is based in Scotland and they've got a wealth of these really amazing places and landscapes. They're comparatively cheaper to film than where I am, which is down nearer London. So again, we were considering where can we film that will look amazing. And we decided a nun's convent and, you know, getting some dark gothic location. Ooh. We've probably bitten off a little bit more than we can chew, but, you know, we'll see. We'll see how things turn out. I think we're at the moment, we've got some amazing footage. We've got a great cast. And again, one of the things I really like about producing myself is having a bit more control on, you know, both the idea that we go ahead with, but also things like casting. I quite like to say on casting.
Yeah, I saw the clip. I mean, it looks really cool. So I'm really excited to, when that comes available, to get a chance to review it. Is there anything else you want to talk about that has either completed or anything that you want to talk about?
Yeah, I mean, just in terms of like The Baby in the Basket, it was one of these things where it was a quite an interesting learning curve in terms of we started off by doing a Kickstarter, which was interesting. A lot more work than you would imagine. So I think we started the whole process of scripting around about this time last year, maybe a little bit earlier. It's just a long, long process. And even as a co-producer now, there's three of us doing the main kind of bulk of the producing. And it's just been a massive amount of work. you know, sometimes you think, well, it would just be easier to just to go and do a Fionado film. 2 weeks, you're done. That's it. Hand it off. But, you know, at the same time, it's exciting. It's rewarding. In terms of my own work, in terms of my script, it's going to be the best thing that I've written. Sometimes you're writing so much towards what a distributor wants and, you know, what can be made for a certain budget level that you're having to make kind of creative compromises, I guess, if you like, or you're having to go, you know, strictly to a certain formula to keep distributors happy, you know, with what they think an audience wants. So this was interesting for me to kind of do something my way and tailor it to how, you know, myself and Nathan wanted to make the film. And, you know, I wouldn't ordinarily kind of put my script into competitions or festivals, but I just thought, you know, why not? I'm going to put it in a few festivals and just for my own like peace of mind, just to see how it does. I've just been amazed. It's won a load of awards already. So it's almost like, wow, I do remember how to write, because you can pick up, you can pick up bad habits writing on commission, I guess. because everything sometimes is laid out for you in a certain, if they want a particular kind of film, you know the formula. So I know the formula of, you know, 90% of sci-fi disaster movies, because most of them are very, very similar. So maybe I'm not stretching myself as much, whereas this one, you know, I was stretching myself more and I was trying to layer in subtext and things like that. They don't want subtext in a Scarecrow's Revenge film. So it was a little bit different, yeah. But
yeah,
we're looking forward to it, seeing how it turns out.
The Baby in the Basket, you talked about it. You were a 2023 winner at the Alfred Hitchcock Award for the Best Horror Script at the Frida Film Festival. The International Gold Awards, you were a winner. Honorable mention, Best Feature Script. Same thing for Best Horror Screenplay, 2023 winner at the Best Script Award. You're a semi-finalist, right? Also, for 2022 winner, Best Feature Screenplay. This is all, you know, Lit Scares International Festival, 8.5 film awards. Wow, that's pretty much, that's pretty awesome.
So there's no pressure on Nathan then for the final film. you know, he's got to deliver a few awards now. We need to, you know, a couple of awards for cinematography and directing. But, you know, from what I've seen from the behind the scenes, sadly, I've not been able to get a chance to get up there just because it's not in the budget.
Right.
Yeah, but no, it's looking great. The cast look great. And I'm sure they're going to deliver something really special. And then quite soon we're going to have a little, we're going to have another Indiegogo campaign just for some extra kind of completion funds and for post-production, just so we can kind of expedite that process and get it out quicker.
Awesome. Now, real quickly before I let you go, I might as well, you mentioned about being able to watch a movie with your kids. I do see two movies here that are completed, Christmas with the Pups and Christmas with the Prince. I'm assuming that's kid-oriented movies?
Absolutely, yeah. That was quite an interesting one because I think it was before last Christmas. I just got asked, do you want to do a couple of Christmas films? I'd never done it before, but it's always been in the back of my mind. I'd love to do something at Christmas. My mind was always thinking more like something like Die Hard, but yeah, I just thought, you know what, I need to, just to flip things up, I need to do something quaint and nice. Christmas with the Pups, I'm particularly looking forward to because that was a little bit more comedic because it's got talking animals. And, you know, I can throw in a few sassy animals there and have a bit of fun with it. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to those two. And
I am too. I'm just a horror fan. I like to watch some Christmas stuff too.
Yeah, because I think, I don't know what it is. As soon as it gets to December, I'll watch, doesn't matter what it is, if it's Christmas themed, I'll watch it. I mean, even something I might, you know, 11 other months of the year, I might think is terrible. Christmas, like Home Alone 5, I guiltily admit, I quite enjoyed it. Five or six, I can't remember, I've lost count, but the new one that they did on Disney, basically, the reboot, I quite enjoyed that one. Yeah, I don't mind. Yeah, and it'll be something fun that I can watch with my daughter as well.
So, no, when are these going to be released? Do you know?
They've had the trailer, so it should be quite soon. I think what they tend to do is they tend to do really awkward things, some of these distributors, where I'm sure they'll release it sometime this month without telling anyone. Because there's been maybe at least half of my films, they've ended up just popping up on, I don't know, Tubi or something, or they've popped up on Amazon. The producers don't know. Scott doesn't know. Becky doesn't know. You know, someone will just sort of tell me, oh, do you know your film's on just popped up on whatever, Tubi? And I say, oh, I didn't know. So they kind of like, you don't get a chance to give anything, any fanfare or like warn people that it's coming out occasionally. But yeah, I'm sure it'll pop up. It probably won't pop up around Christmas time like you would imagine it should. They'll probably wait until the middle of next summer to bring them out.
So. Yeah. All right.
But hopefully it'll come out late November, early December, and you know they'll get a good run on it.
That'd be cool. I'm anxious to see them because it's nice. I love watching Christmas movies, especially around Christmas time. You know, just around Thanksgiving time, you can start watching them. I dig that. So, well, I want to thank you for coming on today. I really appreciate you coming on as a guest. A lot of information.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
You have a lot of talent. But, yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing the films that we talked about. I mean, I have them. I get bombarded by films. So I'm like, you know, you can only have a certain amount of time a day to watch them. So I'm trying to get caught up.
Yeah, I'm the same. I'm the same.
But, yeah. Well, thanks for coming on.
No, thanks for having me. I had a good time.
Awesome. Definitely, I'll get this edited and put it up. I mean, there's not much editing I have to do anyways. Just a couple. But I'll post it on your page, and if you want to share it around, it'll be on YouTube as my YouTube channel. It'll be on Spotify, Amazon Music, you name it. It'll be everywhere.
Yep.
So
good to know.
Thanks again for coming on. If you ever get any screeners for any of the films that we talked about, the new ones, like Baby in the Basket, I would love to see that in the future. Let me know, and I'll definitely check it out for you.
Absolutely, 100%. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you, Scott.
Yep. Tom, you take care, and we'll talk soon.
See you later. Thank you.
Yep. Take care, Tom. We'll see you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.